Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News.
You never close your eyes anymore when I kiss your lips. There's no tenderness like grief in your fingertips. You're trying hard not to show it, but baby, baby, I know it.
Okay, here's the scene. We're in a room at the famed Chateau Marmont in Hollywood. We see two songwriters, a married couple, working at a rented piano. The eccentric record producer Phil Spector is waiting for a killer song. And Barry Mann murmurs, "You never close your eyes anymore when I kiss your lips." The rest of the story, it's in Mark Meyer's new book. He writes that the 45 songs he features are by no means a complete list of best songs ever recorded. Together, he says, they're simply a subjective collection of music milestones that I believe provide us with a greater understanding of the songs, the artists, and the music's history. As Mark joins us this hour, I want to hear from the music heads among us. What's the song that was your music milestone? A song that still evokes the kind of emotion that the best music can. Hearing from a lot of you on Twitter, love it. And if you can tweet in a little backstory, if you can use those 140 characters to tell me a little bit about why that song is your music milestone, I will read them all. I love that. And you can call 651-227-600-800-242-2828. The song that was your music milestone, a song that still evokes the kind of emotion that the best music does. Steph Curtis hanging out at nprnews.org/live and again on Twitter at @CarrieNPR. Mark Myers is a contributor to the Wall Street Journal, where he writes about music and the arts. His new book is titled Anatomy of a Song, The Oral History of 45 Iconic Hits That Changed Rock, R&B, and Pop. And he's with us today from New York City. Mark, welcome. I love the book. I'm so glad you can do this. It's a lot of fun.
Carrie, thanks so much. Wonderful to be with you.
So let's go back to the Chateau Marmont hotel room for a minute, and let's join Cynthia, is it Weil, and Barry Mann at the piano.
Yeah.
Okay. They get two verses into that song, and then they get stuck for the bridge, and they can't figure out how to end the song. And what happens next?
Well, the interesting thing, Carrie, is that iconic opening, "You never close your eyes anymore when I kiss your lips." I asked Barry, I said, the lyricist of the song, I said, where did that come from? That's such a wonderful line. I mean, you just feel every word of it. And Barry said, you know, he had used a similar line a couple of years earlier when he wrote a hit for the Parris Sisters called I Love How You Love Me, if you remember that one. And that sort of opened with, I love how your eyes close whenever you kiss me. So it's the cousin of that famous opening actually has an inspiration that came from Barry himself.
So they're writing through the song. They get a little stuck. They call Phil Spector, and Spector sings, "Whoa, whoa, whoa," over the phone. And Cynthia Weil doesn't really like it. Is that right?
She cringes. Yeah, she cringes. She just feels it's sort of, it's filler. It's cheap filler. You know, it's sort of like a plastic covering on a sofa. It's just making her skin crawl. But, you know, Phil Spector does, you know, of course, when they go up to his house as they're writing this song, all three of them together the next day, he comes up with this hang on sloopy feel that you can hear distinctly in the song that actually helps make the song, the music, pop.
Let's bring it back up here, Mark, and we'll listen.
Love you don't find every day. So don't let slip away. Baby, I need your love.
Okay, is that the part of the song, Mark, that you were talking about, the kind of call and response part of it, or what?
It's that hang on, sloopy, yeah. Hang on. It runs through, it's almost like the dominant color that runs throughout that major portion of that song.
I love the fact that you wrote this little story about Brian Wilson ending up loving the song so much that he calls Cynthia Weil in the middle of the night to tell her.
Yeah, Brian is just crazy about this song. And in fact, when I saw him over the summer, he still raves about this song. And he was just like, I love this song. It's the greatest song I've ever heard, Cynthia. I've got to write with you guys. And her response, typically classic Cynthia, is now. I know.
Yeah, even though Brian Wilson, the amazing Brian Wilson, is on the line. Let me grab a call here from Alec in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Alec, what is that? What's that music milestone for you, and why?
Oh, it's a song that it goes beyond hearing the music. It's when the music first moves you.
Uh-huh.
And it's when I see Aretha Franklin at the Minneapolis Aquatennial sing Otis Redding's Respect. It just went to your core.
Let's listen to it, Alec. Here it is, Aretha
Thanks.
Franklin. Mark, I don't see this song on your list. I've got your book in front of me. Am I right about that?
No,
or
but let's talk about
Good.
This for a minute, because
let's.
Otis Redding, his version is a very grunty, sweaty version. It's almost as if he's farming, right? There's this labor quality to his delivery. It's his song. He wrote it. But like with every song Aretha took on, she completely transforms it, and now it's almost a women's liberation, a demand for equality coming out of her mouth. And that R-E-S-P-E-C-T, that's hers. That's not in Otis Redding's version.
On Twitter here, Lauren says, Sarah from Fleetwood Mac was the moment I started liking good music. The first time I heard it, I fell in love with Stevie Nicks. Vic says, It Won't Be Long by the Beatles still thrills. Aaron says, Talking Heads, Naive Melody, This Must Be the Place. And Steve says, All the Gold in California by the Gatlin Brothers. Earliest memories I have are dancing with Grandma in the kitchen to it. And Mark, I know you've given some thought to this. Tell me why the stories behind the making of the songs are meaningful to us.
Not every song, Carrie, has that impact on people, right? You know, if this were 1969, we would be going on and on about how the Archies' Sugar Sugar was going to be the greatest song of all time. It's just unbelievable. But 20 minutes later, of course, it's just another pop song. The songs in my book, Anatomy of a Song, and I think the songs that touch your tweeters and your callers most, there's a poetry in there. It's almost like a piece of fine art where the artist embeds that piece of art with a message. There's a poetic message. And the person viewing that piece of art or listening to these singles can now hear that message. So in other words, there's a heartbeat behind every one of these songs, and that's what your listeners are picking up on.
Mark Myers is with us. If you've just tuned in, we're talking about his new book, Anatomy of a Song. The book is great. If you love music and you want to know a bit about the story behind how the song came together, how it was written, how it was recorded, what the artists think now of this. That's something that I found really intriguing about some of the stories that Mark tells in the book. That's our conversation, and I want to hear from you about the music milestone, the song that remains a music milestone for you, a song that still evokes, you know, that kind of emotion that the best music does. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 on Twitter at Carrie NPR, where Tojo says, "It's all right, Ma, I'm only bleeding. Step off the page."
Charlie says, "Hurdy-Gurdy Man" by Donovan. "I taped it off the radio. I had headphones and a paper route, and it rocked."
So the phone's to Krista in Cloquet. Hey, Krista, what's your song?
Hi, my song is Alanis Morissette's "You Oughta Know."
Yeah, why?
Well, I was born in the early 80s, and throughout the early 80s, there were all these female pop stars, and Alanis Morissette's song was the first honest, angry, real female artist in my life, and I, you know, there was the grunge stars of the early 90s were mostly men, and this was a woman, and it was just so empowering to hear her sing.
Krista, thanks so much for the call, and here it is. So, Mark, did you find that as you were narrowing down these 45 songs that you were, you were kind of going towards R&B or pop or rock or one of them, or was it kind of spread out?
It was spread out, Carrie. And the interesting thing about your caller just now, you know, what you hear is it's that heartbeat. She's hearing something that connects with her personally. Every one of these songs in this book, it's not a nostalgia trip. Nostalgia is too cotton candy a word. There's a poetic and deep, deep personal connection that people have with these songs, which is why I chose them. And it's the poetry. It's that lyricism. It's where they were. It's what they were experiencing. And the song very often helped them explain themselves and their differences.
I mean, so much of this, Mark, is about, for us, I think, where you were and what was happening in your life. And for a lot of us, it's, you know, you're in your teens, you've fallen in love for the first time, you've had a loss. You know, it's those great emotional milestones that I think connect memory to the music. Yes?
Yeah, these songs crystallize emotion. In other words, we can't explain to ourselves what we're feeling. We try to, you know, we feel a certain way, we feel down, we feel up, we feel all kinds of things. But when we hear certain songs, they seem to completely capture how we feel in music. And as a result, we become married to them. We have this very deep personal relationship to these songs. And it's not that it takes us back to a time when we were eating a sandwich or we were at the beach. It is connecting us to ourselves at another point in time.
Yeah. Cody says on Twitter, "Pictures of You, The Cure, my first great breakup song." Here's one of the things I was curious about, Mark, whether as you learned about the stories behind the songs, I get the sense that you were also learning about, you know, the chemistry of the recording sessions or what was happening between the dynamics of what was happening between the band members, and that informs your appreciation for the music. Is that true?
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Carrie. What I've basically done is, in some ways, for lack of a better way to put it, I've exposed the magic trick, right? In other words, there's some reason why we love She Loves You, or we love, you know, Get Back by the Beatles, or Satisfaction by the Stones, or something by Joni, and we know we love it, but what happens is when you expose the magic trick, how it was done. Unlike a magic trick where when you learn the secret, you no longer care, there's complete disinterest about the trick anymore, You become even more animated when you understand how these things were done in the studio, how they were written, and the accidents that happened to make them possible.
Jim says, "Sweet Thing" from Astro Weeks is the best song on the best album with an amazing creation story. I don't know about the creation. Do you happen to know that, Mark, what the creation story is? Maybe Jim could call to tell us the story. Josh says, "Kazmir Pulaski Day" by Sufjan Stevens. Kelly says, "It's finals week, so Flagpole Sitta, Harvey Danger, Step Off the Page."
Carrie shares one with me. She says, "Roger Miller," and she says, "Trailers for Sailor Rent."
King of the Road.
Yeah, she said she listened to that song over and over in my parents' basement with my siblings' memories flood back every time
I hear
it.
You have a good voice. You want to sing another little?
I do not have a good voice.
Sounded good. You were right on tune. To Siegel in Rochester. Hi, thanks so much for waiting. What's your song and why?
think you're safe in my call. It is On the Road by Willie Nelson.
Tell me why.
I remember listening to that song with my father when I was a kid when he would deliver the dog food deliveries for a food store. And he later on in life became a carrier and would call me from the road. And I got to tour with bands and travel down the road like a band of gypsies. We go down the highway, like kind of always just stuck in my head, and I've always been on the road.
Well, it's going to stick in your head again, because here it is.
On the road again, going places that I've never been, seeing things that I may never see again. I can't wait to get on the road again. On the road again.
We'll listen to a little bit of that in the background, to Willie, to Jay in St. Paul. Hi, Jay. I think you're talking about country music too, aren't you?
Yeah, I just wonder if we could talk about Hank Williams for a bit.
Well, let's.
Someone who's been influential to everybody from Bob Dylan to Leonard Cohen, who talks about Leonard Cohen, who we just lost. He talks about asking Hank Williams, how lonesome does it get? And the song, I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry, I think was introduced by B.J. Thomas to people, 15, 17 years after Hank Williams did it. But like Tony Bennett's recording of Cold, Cold Heart, it was the first introduction to Hank Williams' music to a lot of folks north of the Mason-Dixon line.
Jay,
so you're talking about just raw poetry.
Yeah,
I
Jay, let's listen
so
to it.
Different.
Thanks very much for the call. Here's a song.
I'm so lonesome I could cry. I've never seen a night so long when time goes crawling by.
So, Mark, country didn't make the list. Maybe that's the second book on this.
No, there's three country songs in this book.
Tell me about them.
I interviewed Loretta Lynn on Fifth City.
That's
I interviewed
right.
Merle Haggard on Big City, and I interviewed Billy Sherrill on Stand By Your Man by Tammy Wynette.
Tell us a little bit about Loretta, what she said about Fifth City.
My face hurt when I finished interviewing Loretta. I interviewed her in person, but I was laughing so hard. She is so funny. And she has this way of getting you sort of almost laughing, and then she comes across with a right hook and just knocks you out with humor. There's so much humor in her songs and so much good cheer. But, you know, Fifth City was a revolutionary song when that came out in the late 1960s. She was basically saying that, you know, if you come near my man, I'm not going to take him to task. I'm going to beat you up.
Emma on Twitter says, A Day in the Life by the Beatles. This is something I wanted to ask you about. What kind of insight you got, Mark, into what happens between two creative geniuses like, you know, Paul McCartney and John Lennon? What did you learn about that?
It depends upon which two you're talking about, because a lot of these guys, they work differently. For instance, Cynthia Weil and Barry Mann, they both do words and music. But for instance, you know, with Walter Becker and Donald Fagen, whom I interviewed for Deacon Blues, which is one of my favorite all-time songs, I'm sure yours as well. But it was like a ping pong match. I got to sort of interview them together, and they would finish each other's thoughts. And if one got a little surreal in a description or an answer, the other wouldn't let it go. The other would sort of try to top, and the other would top, and the other would top. And it would get really, really interesting in how they would create this. And that's how they write their songs. They top each other until they have it just right.
Okay, that's exactly what I was curious about, because I don't know if you've read Joshua Wolfshank's book, Powers of Two. And he writes about that collaboration between John Lennon and McCartney and David Crosby and Graham Nash. And that's what he said. The spirit of competition was so powerful into taking
exactly.
this music to new heights that individually they might not have been able to do.
Yeah, what people need to realize, and they do, is that while these musicians are troubadours, in effect, they're singing to our hearts, these are the people at this level are massively competitive people. And when they're in a room with another, even if it's their co-writer, there's competition as to who can contribute the most to the song, who's going to produce that incredible chord change, who's going to come up with that amazing lyric. And it's a competitive experience to be interviewing two songwriters who collaborate on music.
Call here from Susan in Eden Prairie. Hey, Susan, do you have a song?
Yes, For What It's Worth by the Buffalo Springfield. It was the first song that made me think and be socially conscious. It was so different. I was a sophomore in high school, sitting in our sewing room, sewing, listening to Pipestone Radio with Top Hits, and it was so different from all the other songs, and it mixed that social consciousness, and I did stop and look what was going on, and it changed me, and I go back to that every time I hear it.
Here it is, Susan. Listen now. This is Buffalo Springfield's For What It's Worth.
Something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
We're inspired by Mark Meyer's new book, Anatomy of a Song, and I'm asking you for a music milestone, the song that still evokes the kind of emotion that the best music can. Playing a lot of music, hearing from you, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Dare I ask Phil Picardi for his music milestone? Phil, do you know what it is?
Well, we were talking about it with the folks in control earlier. It's Jay Ferguson, Thunder Island.
Thunder Island. Okay,
yeah.
We'll see
Summertime,
if we can find that, Phil.
Yeah, young love, carefree, all that good stuff.
Excellent. Latest news, my friend.
President-elect Donald Trump wants the government's contract for a new Air Force One canceled. Trump tweeted the contract with Boeing for a new presidential plane is costing $4 billion. At Trump Tower, he later told reporters the cost is ridiculous. Trump added, "We want Boeing to make a lot of money, but not that much money." The county that includes Detroit is among six in Michigan that have started recounts today of the state's presidential election results. Seven of the state's other 83 counties have also started recounts this week. An election official says it's possible not all votes will be recounted in Wayne County because of improper seals on ballot boxes and other issues. In such cases, the original vote would stand. The recount continues in Wisconsin. The Supreme Court is siding with smartphone maker Samsung in its high-profile patent dispute with Apple over design of the iPhone. The justices today threw out a $400 million judgment against Samsung for copying parts of the iPhone patented design. The court said Samsung cannot be forced to pay all the profits it earned from 11 phone models because the features at issue are only a tiny part of the devices. The case now returns to a lower court. And German Chancellor Angela Merkel has won a new two-year term as leader of Germany's main conservative party. Her victory came after she said that she's determined to prevent a repeat of last year's huge influx of migrants into Germany. She also said she wants to speed up deportations and ban face-covering veils where possible. The vote is a springboard for her run for a fourth term as chancellor in next year's German elections. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 10:42.
I'm Tom Weber. Next hour on NPR News, Medica's plans to leave the public insurance markets in Minnesota. Then, two University of Minnesota scientists discuss when we should and shouldn't use science to alter nature. That's at 11.
Support comes from Royal Credit Union, supporting community initiatives like River Falls Triangles Park and the YMCA's Camp St. Croix. 25 locations, including Hudson, Coon Rapids, Edina, St. Paul, and Apple Valley. More at rcu.org.
Programming is supported by Health Partners and MakeItOkay.org, a campaign to start conversations about mental illness and stop the stigma. You can learn more about the misconceptions around mental illness at MakeItOkay.org.
Shape is my shade. Like only yesterday, gaze through the glass.
Mark Your Wishes Are Command. There's Deacon Blues. Tell me what you love about that song.
I love the jazz influence. I love the R&B influence. And I love the theme, which is that, you know, losers have dreams too, and that the saxophone is an escape. But it's a wonderful amalgam of all kinds of different styles, including the jazz arranger Oliver Nelson.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit about him and the role he played with the band.
Oliver Nelson is an arranger, a jazz arranger, you know, in the 1960s. And Donald Fagen and Walter Becker loved his sound. They loved the way the saxophones rubbed together in there. And they wanted Tom Scott, the saxophonist, to arrange that song just like, you know, Oliver Nelson would. And he did. And that's why you hear the saxophones are so close together. And Deacon Blues is a phrase that sort of counters Crimson Tide. Crimson Tide being the nickname of the Alabama winning out of Alabama football team, but they wanted a name for losers like the Crimson Tide, and Deacon Blues is what they came up with.
Somebody who tweets as Hot Dad Labs says, Eleanor Rigby, I was 10 years old and forbidden from listening to secular music. My aunt snuck me a dubbed cassette. It changed my life. Mark, I have to ask you, have you been watching the PBS Soundbreakers series?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it's so good. I pulled a little clip about, since we're back onto the Beatles here for a second, I pulled a little clip about the recording of Yesterday, and I thought we could listen to it and maybe talk about what you hear in this. So let's listen.
Yesterday, all my troubles seem so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay.
He said, what do you think then? I said, well, there's nothing we can do to put on top of this that's going to make it more beautiful, except perhaps some strings.
Yesterday, love was such an easy game to play. Now I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
His knowledge of classical music and his arrangements are still the greatest that have ever been done in the context of rock music.
He used strings in a way that was so innovative, I don't think anyone had thought of before. George Martin made strings cool, you know?
That was Roseanne Cash at the end, and then that it was George Martin's son talking about how innovative George Martin was. What do you hear in that, Mark?
You know, there's a big battle over those strings for Yesterday. When I interviewed George Martin in England about, I guess, in 2012, we talked a bit about it. And John was very, very much opposed to adding strings. He felt it was just too much, that it wasn't really necessary. And he was afraid of that song sort of being branded as easy listening. And, you know, when you just played that clip, what was remarkable to me is the song doesn't really need them. And I would argue that they probably didn't have any business on that song, and that Paul is so exposed emotionally, and he's so naked emotionally that one wonders whether those strings, when I heard the strings come in, I said to myself, gosh, you know, maybe John was right.
Well, that's interesting, because see, I don't know as much about music as you do, and when I hear the strings come in, it's just this instinctual yes, you know, that they add some kind of sense of emotionalism to it. And yet when I hear you say the vulnerability of the lyric, that's right. And that,
yeah,
and that kind of covers that up a little bit.
Totally. And it's almost like marshmallow on top of frosting. You know, you don't need the marshmallow. Paul's doing a great job of being as exposed as he possibly could be. So I just wonder whether you needed that string quartet. It would be interesting to play the two together to sort of hear that difference without it and with it.
Rick says on Twitter, Ripple by Grateful Dead. Love this song so much. It was my daughter's lullaby for many years, and Steph off the page.
We have a sugar lover here. Catherine says, I remember cutting sugar from the back of a cereal box and dancing with my brother while played on our console stereo. And Andrea's got a great story. She says, I have a dream and Chiquita from ABBA. My life emotions were mirrored in many bits of the lyrics as my family was emigrating from communist Romania to Germany, looking forward to more freedoms in life with my family, and yet, as a 17-year-old, leaving behind all childhood through high school friends, first love, and not knowing if I'd ever see them again.
Wow. Yeah. Here's Beth. She says, we've only just begun. First 45 at age 10. No idea what was being said, but moved by the voice and the power of music. Goosebumps still. And then D. Roofman on Twitter says, crash into me. Dave Matthews Band caught that teenage angst when I sought connection. And to the phones to Martin in Eagan. Hi, Martin. Thanks so much for waiting. Hey, Martin, are you there? Yeah, hi. What's your song?
Well, this is John from Big Lake.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. Somehow we've gotten our phone lines crossed. But hi, what's your song?
Hi. Yeah, Bob Dylan, no show would be complete without not Bob Dylan, Minnesota's own.
Yep.
Nobel laureate. And the album, so many, but Desire, listening to Joey, listening to Hurricane, or my favorite, Black Diamond Bay, is like listening to a 400-page novel in 7 minutes.
Great way to put it. Great way to. Mark, what would you say about that? About Dylan, too.
Yeah, you know what's interesting? You know, for Dylan, what's fascinating with Dylan for me is that the lyric never enters through the front door emotionally for me.
So well said.
It comes in the side door. You know, it sneaks in the back window. But what's fascinating, Carrie, that I'm hearing from all of your, you know, the tweets and listeners, is that the music, they're never saying, it takes me back to this time when.
Right, yeah.
They're really admiring a song because it reflected how they felt at that moment in time. And that's what makes a song iconic.
Catherine is validating that, Mark. She says, James Taylor, Fire and Rain. First song I heard that wasn't classical music. And I didn't know music could sound like that before. So, Mark, I'm a huge Janis Joplin fan. Mm. I thought we could listen to a little bit of Mercedes-Benz and then talk
Let's
about the
it.
Story that you write about. Here it is.
Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime. No help from my friends. So, oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz?
We'll let it roll a little bit underneath us. I wanted to see if I could hear Janis keeping time with her bracelets and her sandals. Mark, tell that story.
That version that you're listening to is an overdub. In other words, her vocal was originally a cappella, and they sort of layered on, I think later on, they layered on some music underneath it. But that song began as a throwaway line. It was a line of poetry by Michael McClure that wound up in a pool hall where that a lot of pool players were sort of shouting out in San Francisco. Janis overheard it while she was playing pool, and she kept it in her head. And then in 1970, while she's at the Capitol Theater, after the sound check and before she goes on, she's down at a bar with poet and songwriter Bobby Newworth, and at the table are actors Rip Torn and Geraldine Page. And they've got time to kill, and as one drink leads to the next, Rip and Geraldine start keeping time with their beer mugs as Bobby and Janis start to write lyrics to Oh Lord, Won't You Buy Me a Mercedes-Benz.
Wow.
They come up with three stanzas. They go back to the theater. When Janis goes on, it's the second song she sings. And in the booth, you know, when she records this in October of that year, it's the very last song she records because she's in a booth, in a vocal booth, and the machinery had broken down the studio. They had to wait while they took out screwdrivers and tried to fix the tape recorder. And she grew sort of weary and sort of fed up, and she just decided to start singing it. So she stomps with her, you can hear her sandal and the little bracelet going, and she sings it a cappella. And she didn't realize there was music. It was being recorded by a small recorder, Paul Rothchild, the producer, while they were fixing the main recorder. He always had a second one going that nobody knew about. And they captured it. Of course, 3 days later, she dies. And that little cackle at the end, that's it, is so prophetic, isn't it? It's just heartbreaking every time you hear it when you know that information.
It was the last song that she would ever record, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Wow. To the phones to John in Maplewood. Hi, John. What's the song for you, the music milestone?
Hi, Carrie. So
think about music used as psychological operations in combat.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it was the first Gulf War and AC/DC Highway to Hell. So we're crossing the berm, going to attack the Iraqis, and we've got loudspeakers that are blaring Highway to Hell. And I think, you know, it was used to partly intimidate the Iraqis, but it also was used to build up the adrenaline in some young Marines. And every time I hear that now today, it brings me back to that time. And anytime I want to get my adrenaline going, it's AC/DC, Highway to Hell.
You know, John, I was going to ask you if you have kind of an ambivalent relationship then with the song. No, or?
Well, it's a two-edged sword. It's you know, we're going into war, using it for, not the best thing in the world. But on the other hand, it was something that used to get young Marines to want to go into war.
John,
go ahead.
I really appreciate the call. So we've got the song. How about if we play it?
Great.
All right. Kevin on Twitter says Bohemian Rhapsody on Twitter. Oh, and Wide Awake in America, not just the single, but the live EP. My son was born to that. Steph off the page.
Joel says Losing My Religion by R.E.M. I was 11 and my musical tastes were still being formed. This song and accompanying music video changed everything for me.
Okay, and to the phones to Jim in Osceola. Hi, Jim. What's the song for you?
Hi. It's been 9 years since my son's death, but I still can't make it all the way through John Lennon's Beautiful Boy.
Would it be all right with you if we played it?
It would be wonderful.
Okay, here it is. Mark, which story did you hear as you reported the book that really gave you fresh and unexpected insight into the song itself?
Oh, that's a toughie, Carrie. I think so many. Spending 2 hours with Joni Mitchell at her home in California,
wow.
She talked about Carrie late in the afternoon in October, was just staggering when you hear the emotional. Discussion about her breakup with Graham Nash and how she was feeling and how she wound up in Greece. But, Merle Haggard's Big City was, that chokes me up every time I read that piece in my book, Anatomy of a Song, because his story is just the story of how his cranky bus driver didn't want to be in the parking lot any longer waiting for the band to come back to the bus. And Merle gets on there and loves the bus driver, Dean Holloway, complaining about this dirty old city. And he just closes the door, sits down and lets Dean talk. And he captures all these lyrics and he goes back in the studio. They record the song and he comes out to the bus about 20 minutes later with a reel and plays it for Dean Holloway. And he goes, he says to me, old Dean and I just wrote a song. And Dean, was just, he kept saying, damn, he couldn't believe he had written a song. But, then later, his publicist, when I asked, whether Merle loved it, she said that he was on his way to the Grammys by bus, and she read him my article, my Anatomy of a Song on Big City, and she told me by the end he was crying.
Oh, wow.
That really was very touching for me.
Mark, we're going to close with White Rabbit, and I'm just going to tell listeners that they should read the story of the song in the book because it's a good one. I've always been curious about some of the background of this song. So this has been such a pleasure. Will you come back and do it again?
A delight, Carrie. Okay, anytime
good.
You want.
And for me. Thank you. Mark Meyer's book is called Anatomy of a Song, The Oral History of 45 Iconic Hits That Changed Rock, R&B, and Pop.
One pill makes you larger, and one pill makes you small. And the ones that mother gives you don't do anything at all. Go ask Alice when she's 10 feet tall. And if you go chasing rabbits, and you know you're going to fall, tell them a hookah smoking caterpillar has given you the call. Call Alice.
You can read about Mark Meyer's book on the thread, where you will also find our favorite books of 2016 fiction coming tomorrow. NPRnews.org/thread.